big, Bast said matter-of-factly as he gave up the pretense of sweeping. You people are easily confused by the look of things. I've had my eye on him for a while now. He's cleverer than folk give him credit for, always looking at things and asking questions. He carried the broom back toward the bar. He makes me nervous. Quoth looked amused.
Nervous, you?
The boy reeks of iron, spends all day handling it, baking it, breathing its smoke, then comes in here with clever eyes.
Bast gave a profoundly disapproving look.
It's not natural.
Natural?
Chronicler finally spoke up. There was a tinge of hysteria in his voice.
What do you know about natural? I just saw a demon kill a man. Was that natural?
Chronicler turned to face Quoth.
What the hell was that thing doing here anyway?
Chronicler asked.
Looking, apparently, Quoth said. That's about all I got. How about you, Bast? Could you understand it?
Bast shook his head.
I recognized the sound more than anything, Reshi. Its phrasing was very old, archaic. I couldn't make heads or tails of it.
Fine, it was looking, Chronicler said abruptly. Looking for what?
Me,
probably, Quoth said grimly.
Reshi,
Bast admonished him.
You're just being maudlin, this isn't your fault.
Quoth gave his student a long, weary look.
You know better than that, Bast. All of this is my fault. The Skrail, the war, all my fault.
Bast looked like he wanted to protest, but couldn't find the words. After a long moment, he looked away, beaten. Quoth leaned his elbows onto the bar, sighing.
What do you think it was, anyway?
Bast shook his head.
It seemed like one of the Mahael Uret, Reshi, a skin dancer.
He frowned as he said it, sounding anything but certain. Quoth raised an eyebrow.
It isn't one of your kind?
Bast's normally affable expression sharpened into a glare.
It was not my kind, he said indignantly. The male doesn't even share a border with us. It's as far away as anywhere can be in the Fae.
Quoth nodded a hint of an apology.
I just assumed you knew what it was. You didn't hesitate to attack it.
All snakes bite, Reshi. I don't need their names to know they're dangerous. I recognized it as being from the male. That was enough.
So, probably a skin dancer, Quoth mused. Didn't you tell me they'd been gone for ages and ages?
Bast nodded.
And it seems sort of dumb, and it didn't try to escape into a new body,
Bast shrugged.
Plus, we're all still alive. That seems to indicate that it was something else.
Chronicler watched the conversation incredulously.
You mean neither of you know what it was?
He looked at Quoth.
You told the boy it was a demon.
For the boy, it's a demon, Quoth said, because that's the easiest thing for him to understand, and it's close enough to the truth. He began to slowly polish the bar.
For everyone else in town, it's a sweet eater, because that will let them get some sleep tonight. Well, it's a demon for me too, then,
Chronicler said sharply, because my shoulder feels like ice where it touched me. Bast hurried over.
I forgot it got a hand on you, let me see.
Quoth closed the window's shutters while Chronicler removed his shirt. There were bandages stripping the backs of his arms from where he had been wounded by the Skrail 3 nights ago. Bast looked closely at his shoulder.
Can you move it?
Chronicler nodded, rolling it around.
It hurt like 12 bastards when he touched me, like something was tearing up inside.
He shook his head in irritation at his own description.
Now it just feels strange, numb, like it's asleep.
Bast prodded his shoulder with a finger, looking it over dubiously. Chronicler looked back at Quoth.
The boy was right about the fire, wasn't he? Until he mentioned it, I didn't under-
Ah!
The scribe shouted, jerking away from Bast.
What in God's name was that?
He demanded.
Your brachial nerve plexus, I'm guessing, Quoth said dryly.
I needed to see how deep the damage went, Bast said, unruffled. Reshi, would you get me some goose grease, garlic, mustard? Do we have any of those green things that smell like onions but aren't?
Quoth nodded.
Keverell, I think there's a few left.
Bring them and a bandage too. I should get a salve on this.
Quoth nodded and stepped through the doorway behind the bar. As soon as he was out of sight, Bast leaned close to Chronicler's ear.
Don't ask him about it, he hissed urgently. Don't mention it at all.
Chronicler looked puzzled.
What are you talking about?
About the bottle. About the sympathy he tried to do.
So he was trying to light that thing on fire.
Why didn't it work?
What's... Bast tightened his grip, his thumb digging into the hollow beneath Chronicler's collarbone.
The scribe gave another startled yelp.
Don't talk about that,
Bast hissed in his ear.
Don't ask questions.
Holding both the scribe's shoulders, Bast shook him once, like an angry parent with a stubborn child.
Good lord, Bast, I can hear him howling all the way in the back,
Quoth called from the kitchen. Bast stood upright and pulled Chronicler straight in his chair as the innkeeper emerged from the doorway.
Taylu, anyway, he's white as a sheet. Is he going to be okay?
It's about as serious as a frostburn, Bast said disparagingly. It's not my fault if he screams like a little girl.
Well, be careful with him, Quoth said,
setting a pot of grease and a handful of garlic cloves on the table.
He'll need that arm for at least another couple of days.
Quoth peeled and crushed the garlic. Bast mixed the salve and smeared the foul-smelling concoction onto the scribe's shoulder before wrapping a bandage around it. Chronicler sat very still.
Do you feel up for a little more writing tonight?
Quoth asked after the scribe was wearing his shirt again.
We're still days away from any true ending, but I can tie up a few loose ends before we call it a night. I'm good for hours yet.
Chronicler hurried to unpack his satchel, without so much as a glance in Bast's direction.
Me too.
Bast turned to face Quoth, his face bright and eager.
I want to know what you found under the university.
Quoth gave a shadow of a smile.
I supposed you would, Bast. He came to the table and took a seat. Underneath the university, I found what I had wanted most. Yet it was not what I expected.
He motioned for Chronicler to pick up his pen,
as is often the case when you gain your heart's desire.
Chapter 89 A Pleasant Afternoon.
The next day, I was whipped in the wide cobblestone courtyard that used to be called the Quoyen Hale, the House of the Wind. I found it oddly appropriate. As predicted, there was an impressive crowd for the event. Hundreds of students filled the courtyard to overflowing. They peered out of windows and doorways. A few even found their way onto the rooftops for a better view. I don't blame them, really. Free entertainment is hard to pass by. I was lashed 6 times, singly across the back. Not wanting to disappoint, I gave them something to talk about, a repeat performance. I did not cry out or bleed or faint. I left the courtyard, walking on my own 2 feet with my head held high. After Mola laid 57 tidy stitches across my back, I found consolation in a journey to Imre where I spent Ambrose's money on an extraordinarily fine lute, 2 nice sets of used clothing for me, a small bottle of my own blood, and a warm new dress for Auri. It was, all in all, a very pleasant afternoon. Chapter 90 Half-built houses. Every night I went exploring underground with Auri. I saw many interesting things, some of which may bear mentioning later, but for now suffice to say that she showed me all the vast and varied corners of the underthing. She took me to downings, vaults, the woods, delving, cricklets, tenors, candlebear. The names she gave them, nonsensical at first, fit like a glove when I finally saw what they described. The woods didn't resemble a forest in any way, it was just a series of crumbling halls and rooms where ceilings were propped up with thick wooden support beams. Cricklet had a tiny trickle of fresh water running down one wall. The moisture attracted crickets, who filled the long low room with their tiny songs. Vaults was a narrow hallway with 3 deep cracks running across the floor. I only understood the name after watching Auri jump all 3 in quick succession to make it to the other end. It was several days before Auri took me to Below's, a maze of intersecting tunnels. Despite the fact that we were at least 100 feet below ground, they were filled with a steady, rushing wind that smelled of dust and leather. The wind was the clue I needed.
It let me know I was close to finding what I'd come here looking for. Still, it bothered me that I didn't understand the name of this place. I knew I must be missing something. "Why do you call this Below's?" I asked Auri.
"That's its name," she said easily.
The wind made her fine hair stream out behind her like a gauzy pennant.
"You call things by their names. That's what names are for."
I smiled, despite myself. "Why does it have that name? Isn't everything here below?" She turned to look at me, head cocked to one side. Her hair blew around her face, and she brushed it back with her hands.
"It's not Below's," she said. "It's Below's."
I couldn't hear the distinction.
"Below's?"
I asked, puffing out my cheeks as if blowing out air. Auri laughed, delighted.
"That's a piece," she grinned. "Try for more."
I tried to think of what else made sense. "Bellows?" I made a gesture with both arms as if working a forge bellows. Auri thought about that for a moment, looking up and tilting her head back and forth.
"That's not as good. This is a quiet place."
She reached out a small hand and took hold of the edge of my cloak, pulling it out to the side so the slow wind caught it, filling it like a sail. Auri looked up at me, grinning as if she'd done a magic trick. "Billows, of course," I grinned back, laughing. That minor mystery put to rest, Auri and I began a meticulous investigation of Billows. After several hours, I began to get a feel for the place, an understanding of which way I needed to go. It was just a matter of finding the tunnel that led there. It was maddening. The tunnels twisted, leading in wide, unhelpful detours. Those rare times when I found a tunnel that stayed true to its course, the way was blocked. Several passages turned straight up or straight down, leaving me with no way to follow them. One passage had thick iron bars driven deep into the surrounding stone, blocking the way. Another grew steadily narrower until it was barely a handspan across. A third ended with a cave-in of tangled wood and soil. After days of searching, we finally found an ancient mouldering door. The damp wood crumbled to pieces when I tried to open it. Auri wrinkled her nose and shook her head.
"I'll skin my knees."
Shining my sympathy lamp past the ruined door, I saw what she meant. The room beyond slanted down until the ceiling was only 3 feet high. "Will you wait for me?" I asked her as I took off my cloak and cuffed up my shirt sleeves. "I don't know if I can find my way up to the top without you." Auri nodded, looking worried.
"Ins are easier than outs, you know. There's tight places you can get stuck."
I was trying not to think of that. "I'm just going for a look. I'll be back in half an hour." She cocked her head.
"What if you're not?"
I smiled. "You'll have to come and rescue me." She nodded, her face as solemn as an earnest child. I put my sympathy lamp in my mouth, shining the red light out against the pitch blackness in front of me. Then I got down on all fours and headed forward, my knees rubbing against the rough stone of the floor. After several turnings, the ceiling went lower still, too low for crawling. After a long moment of consideration, I dropped to my belly and pressed on, pushing my lamp ahead of me. Each twist of my body pulled at the rows of stitches all across my back. If you have never been deep underground, I doubt you can understand what it is like. The darkness is absolute, almost tangible. It lurks outside the light, waiting to rush in like a sudden flood. The air is still and stale. There's no noise except what you make yourself. Your breathing becomes loud in your own ears. Your heart thumps, and all the while there is the overwhelming knowledge that thousands of tons of earth and stone are pressing down above you. Still, I continued to worm my way ahead, moving by inches. My hands were grimy, and sweat dripped into my eyes. The crawlway grew smaller yet, and I foolishly let one of my arms get pinned to my side. Cold sweat burst out across my whole body as I panicked. I struggled, trying to get it stretched out in front of me. After several terrifying minutes, I managed to get my arm free. Then, after lying there for a moment, trembling in the dark, I pressed ahead and found what I'd been looking for. After emerging from the underthing, I made my careful way through a window and a locked door into the women's wing of the mews. I knocked softly on Fela's door, not wanting to wake anyone accidentally. Men were not allowed unescorted in the women's wing of the mews, especially not during the late hours of night. I knocked three times before I heard a gentle stirring in her room. After a moment, Fela opened the door, her long hair in wild disarray. Her eyes were still half closed as she peered into the hallway with a puzzled expression. She blinked when she saw me standing there as if she hadn't really expected anyone. She was unmistakably naked, with a bedsheet half wrapped around herself. I will admit that the sight of gorgeous, full-breasted Fela half-naked in front of me was one of the most startlingly erotic moments in my young life.
"Quoth,"
she said, maintaining a remarkable degree of composure. She tried to cover herself more fully, and met with mixed success, pulling the sheet up to her neck in exchange for exposing a scandalous amount of long, shapely leg.
"What time is it? How did you get in here?"
"You said that if I ever needed anything, I could call on you for a favor," I said urgently. "Did you mean it?"
"Well, yes, of course," she said. "God, you're a mess. What happened to you?"
I looked down at myself, only then realizing the state I was in. I was grimy, the front of my body streaked with dirt from sliding across the floor. I'd torn open my trousers across one knee, and it looked like I was bleeding underneath. I'd been so excited that I hadn't even noticed or thought to change into my new clothes before I came. Fela took a half step back and swung the door wider, making room for me to enter. As it opened, the door made a tiny wind that pressed the sheet against her body, outlining her nudity in perfect profile for a moment.
"Do you need to come in?"
"I can't stay," I said without thinking, struggling against the urge to gawk openly. "I need you to meet a friend of mine in the archives tomorrow evening. Fifth bell by the four-plate door, can you do that?"
"I have class," she said. "But if it's important, I can skip it."
"Thank you," I said quietly as I backed away. It says a great deal about what I had found in the tunnels underneath the university that I was halfway back to my room at Anchor's before I realized I had turned down an invitation from a near-naked Fela to join her in her room. The next day, Fela skipped her lecture on advanced geometries and made her way to the archives. She climbed down several flights of stairs and through a maze of corridors and shelves to find the only section of stone wall in the entire building that wasn't lined with books. The four-plate door stood there, silent and immobile as a mountain. Valaritas. Fela looked around nervously, shifting her weight from foot to foot. After a long moment, a hooded figure stepped out of the dark and into the ruddy light of her hand lamp. She smiled anxiously.
"Hello," she said softly. "A friend asked me to..."
She paused and ducked her head a little, trying to glimpse the face under the shadow of the hood. You probably wouldn't be surprised at who she saw.
"Quoth?"
she said incredulously, looking around in sudden panic.
"My God, what are you doing in here?"
"Trespassing," I said flippantly. She grabbed hold of me and pulled me through a maze of shelves until we came to one of the reading halls scattered throughout the archives. She pushed me in and closed the door firmly behind us and leaned against it.
"How did you get in here? Lauren will burst a vessel. Do you want to get us both expelled?"
"They wouldn't expel you," I said easily. "You're guilty of willful collusion at the very most. They can't expel you for that. You'd probably get off with a fine since they don't whip women." I shifted my shoulders a little, feeling the dull tug of the stitches across my back, which seems a little unfair if you ask me.
"How did you get in here?"
she repeated.
"Did you sneak past the desk?"
"You're better off not knowing," I hedged. It had been billows, of course. Once I smelled old leather and dust on the wind there, I knew I was close. Hidden away in the maze of tunnels was a door that led directly into the lowest level of the stacks. It was there so the scrivs would have easy access to the ventilation system. The door had been locked, of course, but locked doors have never proved much of a hindrance to me. More's the pity. I didn't tell Fela any of that, however. I knew my secret route would only work as long as it remained secret. Telling a scriv, even a scriv who owed me a favor, simply wasn't a good idea. Listen, I said quickly. It's safe as houses. I've been here for hours and no one's come even close to me. Everyone carries their own light, so it's easy to avoid them.
You just surprised me,
Fela said as she brushed her dark hair back over her shoulders. You're right, though it's probably safer out there. She opened the door and peered outside, making sure the coast was clear.
Scriv, spot check the reading holds periodically to make sure no one's sleeping in here or having sex.
What?
There's a lot you don't know about the archives.
She smiled as she opened the door the rest of the way.
That's why I need your help, I said as we headed out into the stacks. I can't make heads or tails of this place. What are you looking for?
Fela asked. About 1,000 things. I said honestly. But we can start with the history of the Amir or any non-fictional reports of the Chandrian. Anything about either one, really. I haven't been able to find a thing. I didn't bother trying to keep the frustration from my voice. To finally get inside the archives after all this time and not be able to find any of the answers I was looking for was maddening.
I thought things would be better organized, I'd groused.
Fela chuckled deep in her throat.
And how would you do that, exactly? Organize everything, I mean?
I've been thinking about it for the last couple of hours, actually, I said. It'd be best to do it by subject, you know, histories, memoirs, grammars. Fela stopped walking and gave a deep sigh.
Oh, I guess we should get this over with.
She pulled a slim book off a shelf at random.
What's the subject of this book?
I opened it and glanced over the pages. It was written in an old scribe's hand, spidery and hard to follow.
It looks like a memoir. What type of memoir? Where do you put it in relationship to the other memoirs?
Still flipping pages, I spotted a carefully drawn map.
Actually, it looks more like a travelogue. Fine, she said. Where do you put it in the memoir travelogue section?
I'd organize them geographically, I said, enjoying the game. I flipped more pages. Artur, Mordeg, and... Vint? I frowned and looked at the spine of the book.
How old is this? The Aturan Empire absorbed Vint over 300 years ago.
Over 400 years?
She corrected.
So where do you put a travelogue that refers to a place that doesn't exist anymore?
It would be more of a history, really, I said more slowly.
What if it isn't accurate?
Fela pressed.
Based on hearsay rather than personal experience, what if it's purely fictional? Novel travelogues were quite a fashion in Mordeg a couple hundred years ago.
I closed the book and slowly slid it back onto the shelf. I'm beginning to see the problem, I said thoughtfully.
No, you don't, Fela said frankly. You're just glimpsing the edges of the problem.
She gestured to the stacks around us.
Let's say you became master archivist tomorrow. How long would it take you to organize all this?
I looked around at the countless shelves retreating off into the darkness. It would be a lifetime's work.
Evidence suggests it takes more than just one lifetime, Fela said dryly. There are over 750,000 volumes here, and that's not even taking into consideration the clays or scrolls or fragments from Kaluptena.
She made a dismissive gesture.
So you spend years developing the perfect organizational system, which even has a convenient place for your historical fictional travelogue memoir. You and the Scriv spend decades slowly identifying, sorting, and recording tens of thousands of books.
She looked me in the eye.
And then you die. What happens then?
I began to see where she was going.
Well, in a perfect world, the next master archivist would pick up where I left off, I said.
Hurrah for the perfect world,
Fela said sarcastically, then turned and began leading me through the shelves again.
I'm guessing the new Master Archivist usually has his own ideas about how to organize things.
Not usually, Fela admitted. Sometimes there are several in a row who work toward the same system, but sooner or later you get someone who's sure they have a better way of doing things and everything starts from scratch again.
How many different systems have there been?
I spotted a faint red light bobbing in the distant shelves and pointed towards it.
Fela changed direction to take us away from the light and whoever was carrying it.
It depends on how you count them, she said softly.
At least 9 in the last 300 years. The worst was about 50 years ago, when there were 4 new master archivists within 5 years of each other. The result was 3 different factions among the Scribs, each using a different cataloging system, each firmly believing theirs was the best.
Sounds like a civil war, I said.
A holy war, Fela said. A very quiet, circumspect crusade where each side was sure they were protecting the immortal soul of the archives. They would steal books that had already been catalogued in each other's systems. They would hide books from each other or confuse their order on the shelves.
How long did this go on?
Almost 15 years,
Fela said.
It might still be going on today if Master Tolem's Scribs hadn't fully managed to steal the Larkin ledger books and burn them. The Larkins couldn't keep going after that.
And the moral of the story is that people get passionate around books, I teased gently. Hence the need to spot-check the reading holes. Fela stuck out her tongue at me.
The moral of the story is that things are a mess in here. We effectively lost almost 200,000 books when Tolem burned the Larkin ledgers. They were the only records on where those books were located. Then, 5 years later, Tolem dies. Guess what happens then?
A new master archivist looking to start over with a clean slate.
It's like an endless chain of half-built houses, she said, exasperated. It's easy to find books in the old system, so that's how they build the new system. Whoever's working on the new house keeps stealing lumber from what's been built before. The old systems are still there in scattered bits and pieces. We're still finding pockets of books Scribs hid from each other years ago.
I sense this is a sore spot with you, I said with a smile. We reached a flight of stairs, and Fela turned to look at me.
It's a sore spot with every Scriv who lasts more than 2 days working in the archives, she said. People down in the tombs complain when it takes us an hour to bring them what they want. They don't realize it's not as easy as going to the army or history shelf and pulling down a book.
She turned and began to climb the stairs. I followed her silently, appreciating the new perspective. Chapter 91 Worthy of Pursuit. Autumn term settled into a comfortable pattern after that. Fela slowly introduced me to the inner workings of the archives, and I spent what time I could spare skulking about trying to dig up answers to my 1,000 questions. Elodine did something that could conceivably be referred to as teaching, but for the most part he seemed more interested in confusing me than shedding any real light on the subject of naming. My progress was so non-existent that I wondered at times if there was any progress to be made at all. What time I didn't spend studying or in the archives I spent on the road to Imre, braving the coming winter wind if not looking for its name. The Aeolian was always my best bet for finding Denna, and as the weather worsened, I found her there more and more. By the time the first snow fell, I usually managed to catch her one trip of 3. Unfortunately, I rarely managed to have her wholly to myself, as she usually had someone with her. As Deok had mentioned, she was not the sort who spent a lot of time alone. Still, I kept coming. Why? Because whenever she saw me, some light would go on inside her, making her glow for a moment. She would jump to her feet, run to me, and catch hold of my arm, then smiling, bring me back to her table, and introduce me to her newest man. I came to know most of them. None were good enough for her, so I held them in contempt and hated them. They in turn hated and feared me. But we were pleasant to each other, always pleasant. It was a game of sorts. He would invite me to sit, and I would buy him a drink.
The three of us would talk, and his eyes would slowly grow dark as he watched her smile towards me. His mouth would narrow as he listened to the laughter that leapt from her as I joked, spun stories, sang. They would always react the same way, trying to prove ownership of her in small ways, holding her hand, a kiss, a too casual touch along her shoulder. They clung to her with desperate determination. Some of them merely resented my presence, saw me as a rival. But others had a frightened knowledge buried deep behind their eyes from the beginning. They knew she was leaving, and they didn't know why. So they clutched at her like shipwrecked sailors clinging to the rocks despite the fact that they are being battered to death against them. I almost felt sorry for them. Almost. So they hated me, and it shone in their eyes when Denner wasn't looking. I would offer to buy another round of drinks, but he would insist, and I would graciously accept and thank him, and smile. I've known her longer, my smile said. True, you've been inside the circle of her arms, tasted her mouth, felt the warmth of her, and that is something I have never had. But there is a part of her that is only for me. You cannot touch it, no matter how hard you might try, and after she has left you, I will still be here, making her laugh, my light shining in her. I will still be here, long after she has forgotten your name. There were more than a few. She went through them like a pen through wet paper. She left them, disappointed or frustrated. They abandoned her, leaving her heartsore, moved to sadness, but never as far as tears. There were tears once or twice, but they were not for the men she had lost, or the men she had left. They were quiet tears for herself, because there was something inside her that was badly hurt. I couldn't tell what it was and didn't dare to ask. Instead, I simply said what I could to take the pain away, and helped her shut her eyes against the world. Occasionally, I would talk about Denner with Willem and Simon. Being true friends, they gave me sensible advice and compassionate sympathy in roughly equal amounts. The compassion I appreciated, but the advice was worse than useless. They urged me toward the truth, told me to open my heart to her, to pursue her, write her poetry, send her roses. Roses. They didn't know her. Despite the fact that I hated them, Denner's men taught me a lesson that I might never have learned otherwise. What you don't understand, I explained to Simon one afternoon as we sat under the pennant pole, is that men fall for Denner all the time. Do you know what that's like for her? How tiresome it is? I'm one of her few friends. I won't risk that. I won't throw myself at her. She doesn't want it. I will not be one of the 100 cow-eyed suitors who go mooning after her like love-struck sheep. I just don't understand what you see in her, Sim said carefully. I know she's charming, fascinating, and all of that, but she seems rather... He hesitated. Cruel. I nodded. She is. Simon watched me expectantly, finally said. What? No defense for her? No. Cruel is a good word for her, but I think you're saying cruel and thinking something else. Denner is not wicked, or mean, or spiteful. She is cruel. Sim was quiet for a long while before responding. I think she might be some of those other things, and cruel as well. Good, honest, gentle Sim. He could never bring himself to say bad things about another person, just imply them. Even that was hard for him. He looked up at me. I talked with Sovoy. He's still not over her. He really loved her, you know, treated her like a princess. He would have done anything for her. But she left him anyway, no explanation. Denner is a wild thing, I explained, like a hind or a summer storm. If a storm blows down your house or breaks a tree, you don't say the storm was mean, it was cruel. It acted according to its nature and something unfortunately was hurt. The same is true of Denner. What's a hind? A deer. I thought that was a heart.
A hind is a female deer, a wild deer. Do you know how much good it does you to chase a wild thing? None. It works against you. It startles the hind away. All you can do is stay gently where you are and hope in time that the hind will come to you. Sim nodded, but I could tell he didn't really understand. Did you know they used to call this place the Questioning Hall? I said, pointedly changing the subject. Students would write questions on slips of paper and let the wind blow them around. You would get different answers depending on the way the paper left the square. I gestured to the gaps between the grey buildings Elodine had shown to me. Yes, no, maybe, elsewhere, soon. The belling tower struck and Simon sighed, sensing it was pointless to pursue the conversation further.
Are we playing corners tonight?
I nodded. After he was gone, I reached into my cloak and pulled out the note Denner had left in my window. I read it again slowly, then carefully tore away the bottom of the page where she had signed it. I folded the narrow strip of paper with Denner's name, twisted it, and let the courtyard's ever-present wind tug it out of my hand to spin among the few remaining autumn leaves. It danced along the cobblestones. It circled and spun, making patterns too wild and varied for me to understand. But though I waited until the sky grew dark, the wind never took it away. When I left, my question was still wandering in the house of the wind, giving no answers, hinting at many. Yes, no, maybe, elsewhere, soon. Lastly, there was my ongoing feud with Ambrose. I walked on pins and needles every day, waiting for him to take his revenge. But the months passed, and nothing happened. Eventually, I came to the conclusion that he had finally learned his lesson, and was keeping a safe distance from me. I was wrong, of course. Perfectly and completely wrong. Ambrose had merely learned to bide his time. He did manage to get his revenge, and when it came, I was caught flat-footed and forced to leave the university. But that, as they say, is a story for another day. Chapter 92. The Music That Plays.
That should do for now, I imagine, Quoth said, gesturing for Chronicler to lay down his pen. We have all the groundwork now, a foundation of story to build upon.
Quoth came to his feet and rolled his shoulders, stretching his back.
Tomorrow we'll have some of my favorite stories. My journey to Alvaron's court, learning to fight from the Ardim, Thalurian.
He picked up a clean linen cloth and turned to Chronicler.
Is there anything you need before you turn in for the night?
Chronicler shook his head, knowing a polite dismissal when he heard one.
Thank you, no, I'll be fine.
He gathered everything into his flat leather satchel and made his way upstairs to his rooms.
You too, Bast, Quoth said.
I'll take care of the cleaning up.
He made a shooing motion to forestall his student's protest.
Go on, I need time to think about tomorrow's story. These things don't plan themselves, you know.
Shrugging, Bast headed up the stairs as well, his footsteps sounding hard on the wooden stairs. Quoth went about his nightly ritual. He shoveled ashes out of the huge stone fireplace and brought in wood for tomorrow's fire. He went outside to extinguish the lamps beside the waystone sign, only to find that he'd forgotten to light them earlier that evening. He locked the inn, and after a moment's consideration left the key in the door so Chronicler could let himself out if he woke early in the morning. Then he swept the floor, washed the tables, and rubbed down the bar, moving with a methodical efficiency. Last came the polishing of the bottles. As he went through the motions, his eyes were far away, remembering. He did not hum or whistle. He did not sing. In his room, Chronicler moved about restlessly, tired but too full of anxious energy to let sleep take him. He removed the finished pages from his satchel
and stowed them safely in the heavy wooden chest of drawers. Then he cleaned all his pen's nibs and set them out to dry. He carefully removed the bandage on his shoulder, threw the foul-smelling thing in the chamber pot, and replaced the lid before washing his shoulder clean in the hand basin. Yawning, he went to the window and looked out at the little town, but there was nothing to see. No lights, no movement. He opened the window a crack, letting in the fresh autumn air. Drawing the curtains, Chronicler undressed for bed, laying his clothes over the back of a chair. Last of all, he removed the simple iron wheel from around his neck and laid it on the nightstand. Turning down his bed, Chronicler was surprised to see the sheets had been changed sometime during the day. The linen was crisp and smelled pleasantly of lavender. After a moment's hesitation, Chronicler moved to the door of his room and locked it. He laid the key on the nightstand, then frowned and picked up the stylized iron wheel and put it back around his neck, before snuffing the lamp and crawling into bed. For the better part of an hour, Chronicler lay sleepless in his sweet-smelling bed, rolling restlessly from side to side. Finally, he sighed and threw off the covers. He relit the lamp with a sulfur match and climbed back out of bed. Then he walked over to the heavy chest of drawers beside the window and pushed at it. It wouldn't budge at first, but when he put his back into it, he managed to slide it slowly across the smooth wooden floor. After a minute, the weighty piece of furniture was pressed against the door of his room. Then he climbed back into bed, rolled down the lamp, and quickly fell into a deep and peaceful sleep. It was pitch black in the room when Chronicler woke with something soft pressing against his face. He thrashed wildly, more a reflex than an attempt to get away. His startled shout was muffled by the hand clamped firmly over his mouth. After his initial panic, Chronicler went quiet and limp. Breathing hard through his nose, he lay there, eyes wide in the darkness.
"It's just me,"
Bast whispered without removing his hand. Chronicler said something muffled.
"We need to talk."
Kneeling beside the bed, Bast looked down at the dark shape Chronicler made, twisted in his blankets.
"I'm going to light the lamp, and you're not going to make any loud noises, all right?"
Chronicler nodded against Bast's hand. A moment later, a match flared, filling the room with jagged red light and the acrid smell of sulfur. Then gentler lamplight welled up. Bast licked his fingers and pinched the match between them. Trembling slightly, Chronicler sat up in the bed and put his back against the wall. Bare-chested, he gathered the blanket self-consciously around his waist and glanced toward the door. The heavy dresser was still in place. Bast followed his gaze.
"That shows a certain lack of trust," he said dryly. "You better not have scratched up his floors. He gets mad as hell about that sort of thing." "How did you get in here?"
Chronicler demanded. Bast flailed his hands frantically at Chronicler's head.
"Quiet,"
he hissed.
"We have to be quiet. He has ears like a hawk." "How?"
Chronicler began more softly, then stopped.
"Hawks don't have ears."
Bast gave him a puzzled look.
"What? You said he has ears like a hawk. That doesn't make any sense."
Bast frowned and made a dismissive gesture.
"You know what I mean. He can't know that I'm here."
Bast sat on the edge of the bed and smoothed down his trousers self-consciously. Chronicler gripped the blankets bunched around his waist.
"Why are you here?" "Like I said, we need to talk."
Bast looked at Chronicler seriously.
"We need to talk about why you're here." "This is what I do,"
Chronicler said, irritated.
"I collect stories, and when I get the chance, I investigate odd rumors and see if there's any truth behind them." "Out of curiosity, which rumor was it?"
Bast asked.
"Apparently you got soppy drunk and let something slip to a wagoneer,"
Chronicler said.
"Rather careless, all things considered."
Bast gave Chronicler a profoundly pitying look.
"Look at me,"
Bast said, as if talking to a child.
"Think, could some
wagon herder get me drunk? Me?
Chronicler opened his mouth, closed it.
Then he was my message in a bottle, one of many. You just happened to be the first person to find one and come looking.
Chronicler took a long moment to digest this piece of information.
I thought you two were hiding. Oh, we're hiding all right,
Bast said bitterly.
We're tucked away, so safe and sound, that he's practically fading into the woodwork. I can understand you feeling a little stifled around here,
Chronicler said,
but honestly, I don't see what your master's bad mood has to do with the price of butter.
Bast's eyes flashed angrily.
It has everything to do with the price of butter,
he said through his teeth.
And it's a damn sight more than a bad mood, you ignorant, wretched, unhoured fen. This place is killing him.
Chronicler went pale at Bast's outburst.
I'm not...
Bast closed his eyes and drew a deep breath, obviously trying to calm himself.
You just don't understand what's going on,
he said, speaking to himself as much as Chronicler.
That's why I came to explain. I've been waiting for months for someone to come. Anyone, even old enemies, come to settle scores would be better than him wasting away like this. But you're better than I'd hoped for. You're perfect.
Perfect for what? Chronicler asked.
I don't even know what the problem is. It's like... Have you ever heard the story of Martin Maskmaker?
Chronicler shook his head and Bast gave a frustrated sigh.
How about plays? Have you seen The Ghost and the Goose Girl or The Halfpenny King?
Chronicler frowned.
Is that the one where the king sells his crown to an orphan boy?
Bast nodded.
And the boy becomes a better king than the original. The goose girl dresses like a countess and everyone is stunned by her grace and charm.
He hesitated, struggling to find the words he wanted.
You see, there's a fundamental connection between seeming and being. Every fae child knows this, but you mortals never seem to see. We understand how dangerous a mask can be. We all become what we pretend to be.
Chronicler relaxed a bit, sensing familiar ground.
That's basic psychology. You dress a beggar in fine clothes, people treat him like a noble, and he lives up to their expectations. That's only the smallest piece of it,
Bast said.
The truth is deeper than that. It's...
Bast floundered for a moment.
It's like everyone tells a story about themselves inside their own head, always, all the time. That story makes you what you are. We build ourselves out of that story.
Frowning, Chronicler opened his mouth, but Bast held up a hand to stop him.
No, listen, I've got it now. You meet a girl, shy, unassuming. If you tell her she's beautiful, she'll think you're sweet, but she won't believe you. She knows that beauty lies in your beholding.
Bast gave a grudging shrug.
Sometimes that's enough.
His eyes brightened.
But there's a better way. You show her she's beautiful. You make mirrors of your eyes, prayers of your hands against her body. It's hard, very hard, but when she truly believes you...
Bast gestured excitedly.
Suddenly the story she tells herself in her own head changes. She transforms. She isn't seen as beautiful. She is beautiful. Seen.
What the hell is that supposed to mean? Chronicler snapped.
You're just spouting nonsense now. I'm spouting too much sense for you to understand,
Bast said testily.
But you're close enough to see my point. Think of what he said today. People saw him as a hero, and he played the part. He wore it like a mask, but eventually he believed it. It became the truth. But now,
he trailed off. Now people see him as an innkeeper, Chronicler said.
No,
Bast said softly.
People saw him as an innkeeper a year ago. He took off the mask when they walked out of the door. Now he sees himself as an innkeeper, and a failed innkeeper at that. You saw what he was like when Cobb and the rest came in tonight. You saw that thin shadow of a man behind the bar tonight. It used to be an act.
Bast looked up excited,
but you're perfect. You can help him remember what it was like. I haven't seen him so lively in months. I know you can do it.
Chronicler frowned a bit.
I'm not sure. I know it will work,
Bast said eagerly.
I tried something similar a couple of months ago. I got him to start a memoir.
Chronicler perked up.
You wrote a memoir?
Started a memoir,
Bast said.
He was so excited, talked about it for days, wondering where he should begin his story. After his first night's writing, he was like his old self again. He looked 3 feet taller with lightning on his shoulders.
Bast sighed.
But something happened. The next day, he read what he'd written and went into one of his dark moods, claimed the whole thing was the worst idea he'd ever had.
What about the pages he wrote?
Bast made a crumpling motion with his hands and tossed imaginary papers away.
What did they say?
Chronicler asked. Bast shook his head.
He didn't throw them away. He just threw them. They've been lying on his desk for months.
Chronicler's curiosity was almost palpable.
Can't you just...
He waggled his fingers.
You know, tidy them up.
Ampower, no!
Bast looked horrified.
He was furious after he read them.
Bast shivered a little.
You don't know what he's like when he's really angry. I know better than to cross him on something like that.
I suppose you know best,
Chronicler said dubiously. Bast gave an emphatic nod.
Exactly. That's why I came to talk to you, because I know best. You need to keep him from focusing on the dark things. If not...
Bast shrugged and repeated the motion of crumpling and throwing away a piece of paper.
But I'm collecting the story of his life. The real story.
Chronicler made a helpless gesture.
Without the dark parts, it's just some sleep.
Chronicler froze halfway through the word, eyes darting nervously to the side. Bast grinned like a child catching a priest mid-curse.
Go on,
he urged. His eyes were delighted and hard. And terrible.
Say it!
Like some silly fairy story.
Chronicler finished, his voice thin and pale as paper. Bast smiled a wide smile.
You know nothing of the Fae if you think our stories lack their darker sides. But all that aside, this is a fairy story because you are gathering it for me.
Chronicler swallowed hard, and seemed to regain some of his composure.
What I mean is that what he's telling is a true story, and true stories have unpleasant parts. It's more than most, I expect. They're messy and tangled, and...
I know you can't get him to leave them out, Bast said, but you can hurry him along. You can help him dwell on the good things, his adventures, the women, the fighting, his travels, his music.
Bast stopped abruptly.
Not the music, don't ask about that. Or why he doesn't do magic anymore.
Chronicler frowned.
Why not? His music seems...
Bast's expression was grim.
Just don't,
he said firmly.
They're not productive subjects. I stopped you earlier.
He tapped Chronicler's shoulder meaningfully.
Because you were going to ask him what went wrong with his sympathy. You didn't know any better, now you do. Focus on the heroics, his cleverness.
He waved his hands.
That sort of thing. It's really not my place to be steering him one way or another,
Chronicler said stiffly.
I'm a recorder. I'm just here for the story. The story's the important thing after all. Piss on your story,
Bast said sharply.
You'll do what I say, or I'll break you like a kindling stick.
Chronicler froze.
So you're saying I work for you?
I'm saying you belong to me.
Bast's face was deadly serious.
Down to the marrow of your bones. I drew you here to serve my purpose. You have eaten at my table, and I have saved your life.
He pointed at Chronicler's naked chest.
3 ways I own you. That makes you wholly mine, an instrument of my desire. You will do as I say.
Chronicler's chin lifted a bit, his expression hardening.
I will do as I see.
fit, he said, slowly raising a hand to the piece of metal that lay against his naked chest. Bast's eyes flickered down, then up again.
Think I'm playing at some game?
His expression was incredulous.
You think iron will keep you safe?
Bast leaned forward, slapped Chronicler's hand away, and grabbed the circle of dark metal before the scribe could move. Immediately, Bast's arms stiffened, and his eyes clenched shut in a grimace of pain. When he reopened them, they were solid blue, the color of deep water or the darkening sky. Bast leaned forward, bringing his face close to Chronicler's. The scribe panicked and tried to scrabble sideways out of bed, but Bast took hold of his shoulder and held him fast.
Hear my words, manling,
he hissed.
Do not mistake me for my mask. You see light dabbling on the water and forget the deep, cold dark beneath.
The tendons in Bast's hand creaked as he tightened his grip on the circle of iron.
Listen, you cannot hurt me. You cannot run or hide. In this I will not be defied.
As he spoke, Bast's eyes grew paler until they were the pure blue of a clear noontime sky.
I swear by all the salt in me, if you run counter to my desire, the remainder of your brief mortal span will be an orchestra of misery. I swear by stone and oak and elm, I'll make a game of you. I'll follow you unseen and smother any spark of joy you find. You'll never know a woman's touch, a breath of rest, a moment's peace of mind.
Bast's eyes were now the pale blue white of lightning, his voice tight and fierce.
And I swear by the night sky and the ever-moving moon, if you lead my master to despair, I will slit you open and splash around like a child in a muddy puddle. I'll string a fiddle with your guts and make you play it while I dance.
Bast leaned closer until their faces were mere inches apart, his eyes gone white as opal, white as a full-bellied moon.
You are an educated man. You know there are no such things as demons.
Bast smiled a terrible smile.
There is only my kind.
Bast leaned closer still. Chronicler smelled flowers on his breath.
You are not wise enough to fear me as I should be feared. You do not know the first note of the music that moves me.
Bast pushed himself away from Chronicler and took several steps back from the bed. Standing at the edge of the candle's flickering light, he opened his hand, and the circle of iron fell to the wooden floor, ringing dully. After a moment, Bast drew a slow, deep breath. He ran his hands through his hair. Chronicler remained where he was, pale and sweating. Bast bent to pick up the iron ring by its broken cord, knotting it together again with quick fingers.
Listen. There's no reason we can't be friends,
he said matter-of-factly as he turned and held the necklace out to Chronicler. His eyes were a human blue again, his smile warm and charming.
There's no reason we can't all get what we want. You get your story, he gets to tell it. You get to know the truth, he gets to remember who he really is. Everyone wins. And we all go our separate ways, pleased as peaches.
Chronicler reached out to take hold of the cord, his hand trembling slightly.
What do you get?
He asked, his voice a dry whisper.
What do you want out of this?
The question seemed to catch Bast unprepared. He stood still and awkward for a moment, all his fluid grace gone. For a moment it looked as if he might burst into tears.
What do I want? I just want my Reshi back.
His voice was quiet and lost.
I want him back, the way he was.
There was a moment of awkward silence. Bast scrubbed at his face with both hands and swallowed hard.
I've been gone too long.
He said abruptly, walking to the window and opening it. He paused with one leg over the sill and looked back at Chronicler.
Can I bring you anything before you go to sleep? A nightcap? More blankets?
Chronicler shook his head numbly, and Bast waved as he stepped the rest of the way out of the window, closing it gently behind him.
Epilogue. A silence.